Hello and welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. This one is going to be about women. It's quite long, quite good, I think. There's pictures on the website. There's some good videos on the website. If you like horrible histories, they are great. And like I said, that's at fiveofthebest@podomatic.com. The next woman I'm going to talk about was born in France in 1412. Her name was Joan of Arc, and she had an angst against the English. And Joan of Arc was born in Dombrony, which was a part of France which was controlled by the English. This was a time when France was in turmoil, and there's a number of various clans fighting for control of France. You've got the English, who believes it's theirs, you've got the French, who believe it's theirs, the Burgundians, and there's a couple of others, all fighting for control of France. The English, in fact, controlled France, a lot of northern France, all the way up to Paris, past Paris, and a bit on the west side of France. There is a map on the website which shows what France looks like then, very different to it is now. But it shows the various areas and the various factions of what people were fighting for. The fact that the English, it can maybe go back to when the English King William the Conqueror, who conquered England, and he was the first French English king, and he believed that France belonged to them. So we have a number of English Norman kings who believe that France belongs to them, and you've got a number of other factions. The French believe it belongs to, and on and on. So Joan of Arc was born in Dombrony in 1412, and to her parents were quite rich landowners. And Joan was quite religious, and by the age of 13, she claimed to have visions of God and visions of St. Anne and St. Margaret, all telling her how that the Dauphin, which is the Prince of France, would be crowned King of France. A little about the character of Joan. When she was 16, her father arranged a marriage for her, and Joan was so appalled by this that she went to the court and said, she said that this is not a joint, fair, equal pairing. And the court agreed, and they annulled the marriage. But by 16, she knew that her time in Dombrony was coming to an end. She went to a local monastery and told about her visions of about her visions of St. Margaret. And they were so encaptured by her, this girl, that they gave her horses and men and to travel to the French court to look for the Dauphin. So Joan of Arc made her way to the French court, which meant evading the English guards. And she made her way to the French court, and this is where her first miracle is supposed to have taken place, because the French Dauphin was in hiding in court, so you wouldn't know who he was. But Joan saw him straight away, walked straight up to him, told her of her experiences and told her of her visions, and so enchanted with the girl that it must be said that this is a very bright girl, that he gave her armour, he gave her some colours, and he also gave her some men. So Joan left with her armour and her men, and she went to a number of towns and villages which were under siege by the English, and she defeated them. So some very early success from her. She then went to Orleans, which had been under siege for over a year. She sneaked through the English lines and into New Orleans. And once there, she galvanised the men there, and she led a number of surprise attacks on the English. And the English were so set back that they lost a number of them, and eventually they fled through Orleans. So she freed Orleans. And this was one of the things that had to be done if the Dauphin was to be crowned king. So it seemed that... the Dauphin was made his way to Rouen to be crowned king. He used to be crowned king, King Charles the VII. And Joan was there in attendance, just 20 metres away from him. In fact, she had the only banner in the whole cathedral. And when asked why that it was just her banner allowed in the cathedral, she said that this banner represents honour and it deserves to be here. This was an 18-year-old girl who's done all this. Anyway, a year goes by, and she starts again trying to clear the English away from the French, English away from the French territory. And things took a change for a worse while trying to defend a French town. She was out in the fighting the English, and all her soldiers decided to scarper back to inside the gates, and she was caught outside the gates. And in fact, she wasn't fighting the English, she was fighting the Burgundians, and the Burgundians captured her and held her ransom. The Burgundians held ransom to her, and King Charles did not pay, for one reason or another, didn't pay. But someone who did was the English. The English paid the ransom, and so she was handed over to the English. And their thinking was that if they could disprove the fact that she saw these saints who then led to the King Charles being King Charles, that they could disprove that and she can prove that she was a heretic, that the whole King Charles thing would be an illegitimate crownship and the crown would still be up for grabs. Anyway, she went on trial, and at trial we know everything she said because the English recorded every single word she said. And she comes across as a very bright girl. The court, at a number of times, has made mistakes. And Joan pointed out that a few days afterwards, she points the mistake out. They go to her records and find that she is spot on right. This happens more than once. Anyway, at trial, they try to imply that Joan did not see these visions of St. Margaret and St. Anne. And in fact, when they ask her, what language does St. Margaret speak? English, right? She replies, no, why should she? She doesn't support the English. And this goes on. In fact, it's not all sweetness and light. She does have a temper, but what teenager doesn't? And anyway, when she's taken back to jail, she's given the chance because she's wearing men's clothing at this stage. And she's given a chance when she goes back to jail to wear men's or women's clothing, and she always chooses the men's clothing. And it's for this flimsy reason that they can conflict of heresy. And it was this one which has tried to claim that King Charles was an illegitimate crowning, and she was put to death. And she was put to death in May 1431. And she was burnt at the stake. Her death led to a large backlash. She had become a female heroine of the French country. And it is her this which saw the French backlash and eventually kicked the English out of France. And in 1910, she became a saint. The next woman I'm going to talk about is of Boadicea. She is an English Celtic warrior. In fact, Boadicea was the wife of a Celtic king called Brugustus. And they lived in Norfolk, which is the bottom part of the UK to the east. And in 34 BC, the Romans invaded Norfolk and they crushed the Celtic tribes and forced them to submit under Roman law. They did allow two tribes to remain, and Procrustes' tribe was one of them, just sort of to appease the people. But under Roman law, they had a poor time, and the Romans tried to change their culture, they tried to change their religion, they imposed heavy taxes on the local indigenous people, and the taxes were so great that the king, Procrustes, had to take out a grant from the Romans, so though they could pay the Roman taxes. In 60 AD, King Procrustes died, leaving the throne to his wife Boadicea. Emperor Nero came in to collect the huge debt which Procrustes had came to pay their taxes. And of course they couldn't do so. And so the Romans then decided just to take half of Boadicea's land. And then they decided to publicly flog her. And then they decided to rape her daughters and let everyone know that we've raped her daughters. And then they decided to take the rest of her land. Anyway, unsurprisingly, this led to a rebellion. This is when Boadicea then roused an army of 30,000 people to fight against the Romans. Boadicea rose an army of 30,000. They then went onto a rampage
against the Romans. They swept across the country, defeating Roman garrisons and taking no prisoners. They swept across the country until they came to Colchester. Now, Colchester was the main capital of the area, the main administration centre of the area. They laid siege to Colchester. They defeated the Romans there. They then entered the city of Colchester and they again killed every woman, man, child there. They killed 70,000 people there as they were considered as collaborators. This is not a good luck or good feel story in any level. The success continued with victories over St Albans, and other towns just fled as soon as they learned that Boadicea was coming. This came to an end when they came to the suburbs, if they had suburbs 2,000 years ago, of London, or as it's called the Londinium. This is when the Romans really got their act together, and they gathered an army of 10,000 soldiers, and they were facing an army, Boadicea's army, of around 80,000. But it must be said that Boadicea's army was a very ragtag army, and the Roman army was a very much a professional army. So two armies met, and Boadicea is very famous for riding a chariot. Whenever her armies went into battle, she used to ride a chariot, giving rousing speeches to lift the men's spirits. Anyway, despite the Romans being vastly outnumbered, some people saying 10 to 1, the Romans absolutely slaughtered Boadicea's army. And some say that less than 800 of the Romans died, and
up to 80,000 men of Boadicea's army died.
So it was an absolute slaughter. Anyway, Boadicea was captured, and one of her aides, in fact, managed to smuggle some poison to her, and she took the poison when she was in prison and died. The next woman I'm going to talk about is Argentinian, and her name is Eva Perón. Eva was born in 1919. And her father was a rich landowner, but she was already married when he met Eva's mother. But Eva's mother became his mistress, and they had five children together. And life for a short time for Eva was all right. And this was until her father died. And at this stage, Eva's family was not allowed to attend the funeral, and shortly after, they were forced to leave the area. Her mother moved to a one-bedroom flat with her five children, and she worked as a seamstress, a cook, a nanny, anything to make a living. Things got a little better for Eva when Eva's big brother managed to buy a big house. They transformed this into a boarding house, and this was the stability that Eva needed. By 15, Eva was performing in school musicals and musical plays. She was helping out in theatres, and this is what she set her heart on doing, to become an actress. By the age of 17, she left home to move to Buenos Aires to find work as an actor. And for a number of years, she actually did work in theatre groups, in musicals, and she also had a very good modelling career. Her big break came in 1936 when she joined a theatre company that specialised in radio drama. And this is where Eva really did thrive. By 1943, she was the highest paid actor. This is mostly done because of her radio drama series, although she did appear in a number of B-movies and other theatre productions. By 1944, she was the highest paid actor or actress in Argentina. In 1994, in Argentina, that's 1944, not 94, 44, they had a massive earthquake, and it killed over 10,000 people. And this led to the Actors Performance Union, which Eva was president, to decide to put on a number of events to raise aid for the people of the area. This brought her to the attention of Juan Dominic Perón, who was the Labour Minister of the country. The two met and a romance started. A little about Argentina during the 1920s, 30s and 40s. These were heady days, a utopia if you're a rich landowner. But in reality, this was a world of haves and have-nots, and millions of people were the have-nots. And if anyone knew this, it was Eva. Eva knew this. In 1944, Eva started a brand new soap a brand new radio drama, a soap opera, and it was called Together to Be a Better Future. And this was about ordinary people wanting a better future for themselves and the country. And very quickly, Eva became the voice of the people. Other things that happened in 1944, she also married Juan Perón. Juan Perón agreed with a lot of Eva's concerns about the country. And together, in fact, they toured the country and did a number of speeches saying that the workers should be rewarded for their labour and not persecuted. With the growing voice of discontent throughout the country, this led to the president of the country resigning. In fact, many of the government believed that they blamed this on the fact of Juan and Eva Perón. They were arrested, and the following day, over 300,000 people stood outside Government House demanding for their release, and of course they were. In 1946, there was another general election, and Juan and Eva Perón won very easily. They still had a big fight on their hands, because although they were elected, the other members of the other MPs were supporting the rich landowners, so they tried to block everything they did. Juan Perón became president, and Eva Perón became Secretary of Labour. And through her fighting, she gained higher wages for the working classes, a greater social benefit, and a welfare state. She also ensured that people working in factories had good working conditions, and she toured a number of hospitals, and she started a vaccination program, and through better healthcare, she eradicated such crippling diseases as tuberculosis, leprosy, and malaria. During her second term in 1950, she in fact contracted cancer, but she continued to give some of her most powerful speeches during this time. In fact, she died of cancer on 26th of July 1952, aged just 32. She massively improved the lives of millions of people during this time. But she was less popular by the elite rich. The next woman I'm going to talk about is of a Greek woman who became the most famous Egyptian queen ever. I'm talking, of course, about Cleopatra. Cleopatra was born in Alexandria, Egypt, but her parents are Greek, her great-great-parents were Greek. In fact, she can trace her Greek lineage back 300 years to when Alexander the Great, who swept through Europe, swept through Asia, and swept through Egypt and conquering that. When he left Egypt, he left one of his generals there, General Ptolemaeus, to be the new ruler of the country. And it's him and his lineage for the next 300 years who were the rulers of Egypt, all the way up to Cleopatra. There wasn't much chance of getting in this family if you weren't Greek, and very little chance if you weren't in the family. There was a lot of inbreeding in this family. In fact, Cleopatra's mum and dad were, in fact, brother and sister. And, in fact, she had five brothers and sisters altogether. So how did a little Greek family control all of Egypt for over 300 years? Well, they would become very reliant on the fact that they were being propped up by the Romans. The Romans did this because it was beneficial for them. It opened the Asia up for trade. But the thing was is that their family was becoming more and more indebted to the Romans. When Cleopatra's father died, succession passed to Cleopatra's older sister. And she survived 2 months before being poisoned. And then Cleopatra's next older sister took the throne, and she survived 3 months before being poisoned. No one can point the finger at Cleopatra for definite, but these two deaths led the way for Cleopatra, an 18-year-old Cleopatra, to become the new queen of Egypt. And she did things a little differently. She, in fact, immediately married her 10-year-old brother. Cleopatra then started to run her country by herself, pushing her husband or brother aside. She made rulings and rules and laws, and she minted coins with her head on it solely. And this worked well for a couple of years. But then her brother, her husband, his supporters became more vocal and aggressive, and they actually forced Cleopatra to flee the country, leaving his brother in control.
And for one person of one country, Rome, this squabbling was no good. This was not working for them because Egypt still owed them a lot of money. And Julius Caesar said, right, I'm going to come put an end to this. I'm going to get you two together. So they met in Rome, and the idea was to sort this squabbling out once and for all. It was at one person's advantage that if Cleopatra did not attend this meeting, and that was Cleopatra's brother or husband, and he set out guards to arrest her, to put under arrest so she could not attend this meeting. But Cleopatra did attend the meeting. In fact, she was smuggled into Julius Caesar. She was inside a roll of carpet, and this actually did happen. There's a lot of evidence that this happened. Whether it happened like it did in the movies, we don't know, but this seems to have happened. Anyway, the meetings went ahead, and Julius Caesar banged heads together, and they both agreed to share rule together. Cleopatra's husband went back to Egypt, and Cleopatra stayed with Julius Caesar. They started meeting each other, they started a relationship, and at this point it's got to be said that Julius Caesar was 53 and Cleopatra was 23. But they did have things in common. Both of them were very bright, and both of them were very ambitious. They started a relationship. It was now that Cleopatra seemed to persuade Julius Caesar to send an army to Egypt to defeat his brother so she could become sole ruler. And this is what happened. And a bonus for them both was the fact that her brother, her husband, was killed during the fighting. In fact, he was killed while fighting in Nile, and he had drowned. Anyway, so Cleopatra became sole leader, and Julius Caesar came over to stay. In fact, the stay was a very long stay. In fact, so long that Julius Caesar was being criticised for being away from Rome for so long. Anyway, on hearing this, he went back to Rome, and Cleopatra just came back with him. So the pair left for Rome. Back in Rome, Cleopatra and Julius Caesar continued as before. He was a married man, and this was frowned upon, as well as other things, such as he took down a statue of Venus and put up a statue of Cleopatra. There was discontent before he came back, and this only added to the discontent. And Julius Caesar went to the Senate on the Ides of March to try and calm everyone down. As he went to the Senate, approached to speak to people, he was set upon by 40 members who stabbed him to death. I mean, this attack was a vicious attack. And Cleopatra was less than a mile away when this happened. Cleopatra returned to Egypt, unsure whether she was going to have any more Roman support. In Egypt and in Rome, things looked equally unsure. Julius Caesar took over, Sir Caesaron. He was a 19-year-old, and he thought it was best if he would co-rule with someone else. And he thought the best person to do that is Julius Caesar's best friend, Mark Antony. And it was decided that Sir Caesaron would look after the European arm of the Roman Empire, and Mark Antony the Asian bit. Mark Antony went to Egypt to raise an army to continue conquering of the new Roman Empire. He met Cleopatra, and as far as Cleopatra was concerned, here was another Roman ruler who, if she got his support, could to secure her future. Cleopatra, who already had a young son through Julius Caesar, then met Mark Antony. They knew each other quite closely, because Mark Antony was Julius Caesar's best friend. And they met more and more, and sure enough, another romance started. This relationship lasted a number of years. In fact, they had 3 children together. And he was spending more time in Egypt, and he was even saying things that Julius Caesar's son should become the new ruler of the new king of Egypt. Now, to the Romans, this enraged Romans. Mark Antony was sent there to enlarge the Roman Empire, not to start a breakaway kingdom. And so, in response, they sent an army. And it is now, really, that we get the modern image of what Cleopatra was, because the Romans started to use this propaganda, saying that Cleopatra was this beautiful woman who used to seduce men, and she was only interested in sex and enjoyed all the good things in life. And if a man refused to have sex with her, he would put her to death. And it's the image that we all have now of her. In fact, images of her from her coins and other images we have her, we know that she had a big Greek nose, and there is a picture, or was a statue of her in a museum, and she's no beauty. She's not unpretty. In fact, people have described her as ordinary. So the Roman army invaded Egypt to overthrow Cleopatra. They weren't really interested in Mark Antony, but Mark Antony used his army to try and fight the Roman army, which was a disaster, because most of them were Romans or considered themselves allegiance to the Romans, so they ended up deserting. Anyway, Mark Antony learnt that Cleopatra had committed suicide, so he fell on his sword, only to find that it wasn't true. Anyway, dying, he went his way, made his way to Alexandria, and in fact died in Cleopatra's arms. Anyway, the jig for Cleopatra was on the cards. The Romans were coming, and there was really very little option. She decided to commit suicide. She did this by having a bowl of prunes, and inside the prunes there was an asp, or a cobra. And the cobra bit her, and she died. Oh, that was the end of the Roman Empire. And after that, the Roman Empire took over charge of Egypt, and that was the last pharaoh of